crucial section where Paul is trying to demonstrate the need for the gospel. And he started that in verse 18. For the wrath of God is going to be revealed against all unrighteousness. And the underlying premise is the gospel is the good news of salvation by Jesus Christ to those that believe. But it's only good news if you realize the problem you're in, correct? And so, you know, hey, you've got cancer. Well, that's bad news. Well, the good news, there's a cure for it, right? Well, that's exciting. So it offsets the trauma of the bad news. Now, sadly, I don't know how to put a percentage on it, but let's say most people are not aware of the danger they're in. And it's not because God's going to punish them arbitrarily, because that's what he does. But we all have this spiritual sickness called sin. It's a cancer, is what it is. That's the bad news, but most people are not conscious of it. They're not aware of how holy God is, and yet we have to someday stand before him. And when we stand before him, there's nothing we can say on our defense. I mean, he is so holy and so pure that, well, it says we cannot approach him. We can't see him. And so what are we going to do about that? And so Paul, in trying to demonstrate to these Christians, and you got to understand they're Christians that are tending to go back to their identity, especially the Jewish Christians, about introducing kind of a work salvation. You got to do this, circumcisions, different things to be right with God. And Paul's trying to argue and show with them, nobody can do enough and be good enough in of themselves to make it to heaven. And he has to show people that's the case. And so the first section in chapter 1 and in chapter 2 has to make us, if we listen carefully, feel terrible about ourselves outside of Christ. All right? Terrible. And now you say, well, should that make me feel that way? Yeah, well, not necessarily, because if we're in Christ, we're going to see when Paul concludes, there's nothing we can be condemned for. But yet it's still sometimes we fall into this works mentality that, well, I got to be good enough to make it to heaven. And so we keep struggling. We don't have this peace of the gospel. And so we're going to try to rid that from our thinking as well, because sometimes it's healthy to go back and rethink our salvation and understand it was never based on anything we did. It's only based on what God has done for us. So first of all, Paul went and turned to the world at large, not talking specifically about the Jews and how they fell into sin. And we saw that the reason for this, and that's what we tried to diagram last week, is that everyone knows about God without excuse. So we don't have to even defend God's existence, because everyone knows. And that's the premise that Paul works on. And the more and more you work with people and talk to people, we all know there's a God. And because he's made himself abundantly clear. Well, then why don't people honor God? Because we saw that the reason is that people suppress the truth. That's a conscious decision. And we wrote on the board last time, you would think your thinking would drive your actions. Intellect would drive your will. But in this case, it's someone's will that now is going to drive and dictate their intellect. Now, what do I mean by this? If I know something to be true, that should direct my actions. And we explain gravity. We believe it's true, so it directs how we act on this earth. We don't jump off cliffs unless we want to die. But what happens when you know something to be true, but you do not want to act on it because you don't like the implications? Now we have a problem. So a person will choose to suppress that truth and regard it as not true, and that's now going to give them license, so they think, to do what they will. So now their volition, their conscious choice, is now determining how they think. There is no God. Well, where'd you come up with that? And then you cannot reason with that person reasonably, because no matter what you say, They're going to have an excuse or some way to deny God's existence. And we gave some demonstration of that last week. And that's why it's futile sometimes to talk with people that are in this paradigm. We call it spiritual or mental dissonance with that which they know to be true, conflicts with what they're saying and what they're thinking. And it's a mental and a spiritual condition. And Paul is outlining that here in this text. Now, it goes from the mental then to the action. And that's where we've left off. And I want to go through this kind of quickly. Because we saw that they suppressed the truth. And they chose not to honor God or give him thanks. And then they exchanged the glory of God for a lie, but the living creatures. Because man is always made to worship something. And that's what he's going to find. And so he started worshiping creation rather than the creator. And that's going to be their self-fulfilling purpose in life. Because everyone's looking for purpose. Now, if God is the originator of all things and he made us in our image, that would mean our purpose is in him. In Acts 17, it's in him whom we move and even exist. You know, he is the source of our being. But yet if you reject him, you're going to have to find an alternate reality. And I'm going to call it alternate reality because it's not real. So that's why people have causes, don't they? What are some of the current causes today? Environmentalism, right? I'm sorry? Yeah, curing cancer, right? So you can live longer and longer.
Protect
now,
the animals.
Huh? Protect animals. Animals' rights. We use that as a demonstration. Now, are all those things good in themselves?
Stewardship.
Yes, stewardship of animals. God calls us to be good stewards, all right? Take care of your body. You want to heal cancer. You want to take care of the environment. But all those are substitutes for the real thing, right? And when that happens, they end up start worshiping it. And so, like in Portland, you can get in real trouble if you cut down a tree. Seriously.
Yes.
Fine, big time. You know, you're working for PG, you knew that. You know, and how big fines can they get?
Well, they go by the age of the tree, the diameter of the tree. I mean, it can go into tens of thousands.
Tens of thousands of dollars for cutting down a tree. We're worshiping the creation rather than the creator. But it's a cause and it's out of whack because it's not put in perspective of a top-down approach. Well, that's what they're doing, exchanging the truth of God for a lie. Now, that's why God now says, here's what I'm going to do. And we're going to see three times he says, God gives them over. Now, there's a lot of ways people try to explain this. One, he says, well, I'm just going to remove my protection from you and just we'll see what happens. It could be I'm just going to, it's a permissive thing. Well, just do what you want then. But I'm going to think if we look at this language and you study it out, it's more of a judgment type of terminology. Because when you gave someone over, that language would be often used to give someone over to the courts or give them over to the authorities to be punished. And so three times Paul's going to use this language about God that he gave them over. So here's what I want you to see. A person refuses to acknowledge God, refuses to honor him, refuses to glorify him or give him thanks. Then they exchange the truth of him for a lie, and now that's their faith system, this lie. Now they're going to base all their action on that. Is that a total willful rejection of God? So God, verse 18, God's wrath will be upon all unrighteousness. He said, okay, I'm going to let you have face judgment even here on this earth. Because don't be deceived. Whatever a man sows, he will reap. And sometimes we'll receive the due penalty of our error. And what means that is sometimes what happens culturally in society is God's judgment upon us for our choices. He said, really? Well, yes. So look what happens. God gave them over, first of all, to lust their hearts, to impurity. So their bodies would be dishonored among them. And so, first thing, I'm just going to let your lust control your thinking and your lives. Now, Remember, Paul is writing to the church where it's, which is at where?
Rome.
And Rome was the icon of purity and morality, wasn't it? And we think, well, this is talking about today. We could spend the rest of the class talking about this, but just a couple quotes. This is from Virgil. Right and wrong, or talking about Rome, are confounded. So many wars the world over, so many forms of wrong. No worthy honor is left to the plow. The husbandmen are marched away and the fields grow dirty. The hook has its curve straightened into a sword hook. Tacitus came to write the history of this period, saying, I'm entering upon the history of a period rich in disasters, gloomy with wars, rent with sedition, savage in every hours of peace. He talks about Suetonius, that no day has passed that someone was executed. It's an age of sheer utter terror. Rome, says Livy, the historian, could neither bear its ills nor remedies that might have cured them. Propertius, the poet, wrote, I see Rome, proud Rome, perishing, the victim of her own prosperity. How many times have we said prosperity is a blessing and it's also a curse? It's an age of moral suicide. Juvenal, the satirist, wrote, the earth no longer brings forth anything but bad men and cowards. Hence God, whenever he is, where whoever he is, looks down, he laughs at them and hates them. Seneca said it's an age stricken with agitation of soul that no longer is master of itself. In the public baths of Rome, the hot and cold water ran from silver taps. Caligula had even sprinkled the floor of the circus arena with gold dust instead of sawdust. Can you believe that? The prosperity, how rich it was? Juvenal said bitterly, a luxury more ruthless than war broods over Rome. No guilt or deed of lust is wanting since Roman poverty disappeared. Money, the nurse of debauchery and inveterating riches, don't know that word, sapped the sinews of the age with foul luxury. And he just goes on and on and on. Here, let me just read this. Juvenal writes, is one husband enough for Iberna? Soon will you prevail upon her to be content with an eye. He cites the case of one woman who had eight husbands in 5 years. Now, do we see multiple marriages today the same way? You know, Anne and I were talking about some celebrity, and they had five wives, this person, all right? He cites the case, they show a dauntless spirit in the things they basely dare. There's nothing that Paul said about the heathen world that the heathen moralists had not themselves already said. So everything they're saying that Paul is going to say, their own people said this before. Vice did not stop with the crude and natural vices. Society from the top to the bottom was riddled with unnatural vice. 14 out of the first 15 Roman emperors were homosexuals. Now, we go on and on and on about that. This is the condition that existed in Rome, which Paul's addressing and he's explaining how they got there. And this condition can be outlined for us today because we're quickly going down the same path. Now, I don't know if it'll be averted or what, but it starts with this suppressing of the truth. Now, when you let your lust drive you, God gives you over. And I want you to see it as a punishment. That's what he's saying. Because you're not going to like where it's going to take you. Where it's not reason dictating your behavior, it's desires. And in that, our society, if it feels good, you know, do it. And don't you judge anyone, because if you do, you're trying to control that person, you're being a bigot or whatever. And so really, it's a life in the United States of narcissism where it's all about me. And so any form of behavior is going to end up being acceptable. And you say, well, any form, who would have guessed there would be same-sex marriages 10 years ago? Just 10 years ago or 5 years ago. And now, anytime you speak out against same-sex marriages or homosexual lifestyle, that's hate speech. You can be fined. And we had Bill Downing talk about how he lost his job over that. Even though he did it on his private time, had nothing to do with work. And it's going to get worse. And so if someone's listening to this tape and they want to make a case against me, I'm just repeating what Paul said, and I stand behind it because this is God's will. It's not Jack Aver speaking. And in America, so far, still, we have the right to express our faith, don't we? And if you have a problem with that, don't take it up with me. Take it up with God. That's my little disclaimer because someone's probably going to listen to this. And I don't say this with malice or, you know, it's sad because where we're going. And so we'll look where it comes next. This, he goes, well, when you worship a false god and turn from God, and then he fills your heart with just whatever you want to do, if you're going to worship a god, who's going to pick that god? Because there is no god directing your life. You're directing your own life. You'll pick your own god. Who will write the rules for worshiping that god? You do. Why? Because you're in charge. Really, who is the god of your life? You are. Well, Satan is actually. But you're taking control. You're taking sovereignty for yourself in suppressing God. So when you're writing rules for what you want to do, what is that going to be based on? What you like or what you don't like? It's generally going to be on what short-term pleases me, because we are not mature enough, generally, I'm, you know, given a stereotype, to think long-term, to deny ourselves of things that are harmful. We'll do them now. So why did people smoke before? Because they were ignorant. Why do people continue to smoke today? Why? Because they want to. That's the only reason, isn't it? You know, and it makes no sense, but they want to, and they don't care about the long-term effects until they happen, right? Well, that's what happens here. And he said, well, how does it get to sexual immorality? Well, it's just like, I'll just use alcoholism. When you first took your first drink, for anyone that ever has in here, and I imagine that's most of us, how much did it take to give you that first alcoholic buzz? Not much. Now, if you drank a lot over time, would that first amount produce the same effect? What do we call that? Tolerance. And so what do you need to add to that first amount? More and more and more. That's true pretty much with anything. You know, extreme sports. What is the drug they're trying to achieve, largely?
Adrenaline.
And there's nothing wrong with that in itself. It's exciting. We're kind of attracted to it. Like, look what they're doing, those crazy people. And I'd never do that, but we're excited watching them because it even gives us a minor little release of adrenaline that creates dopamine and all that. And we live vicariously through them, saying, oh, I would have done that. You know? But what happens after you, you know, helicopter skied down the face of a cliff? What happens if you've done that 5 times? Boring. Yeah, it's boring. Like, boring? Something bigger cliff, right? All right? So it just, you have to get something bigger, more exciting. Is that true in the movie industry? Remember the first explosions in the big action films? You know, I'm going back for before some of you were born, you know. The first Star Wars. Or even the Indiana Jones, Raiders of the Lost Ark. Man, that was epic. But now you look at it, oh, that was nice, you know, but there's not enough explosions. There's not enough things blowing up, you know, buildings dropping. And is that not true? Because we are bored with what we've already seen. We want more and more. Is it true in the sexual realm when you're giving yourself over to just the pursuit of sexual pleasure? It's interesting. They say men love, boys, this is the saying, boys love to have sex, girls love or have sex to get love. Let me say it again. Boys will give love to have sex. Girls give sex to have love. Shows how often the motives are different. But let's just take the boys. They give love so they can have sex. Now, is that a stereotype? Yes. But it's what afflicts people. It's their body driving them. And so the problem with like pornography is it introduces you to a world without any restraints, right? No inhibitions. And that which once was first exciting no longer is exciting the f- 8th time, just like a drug, right? So you need something more out there, more bizarre, more deviant. And then after you're introduced to that, your threshold's lowered again, and that doesn't have the same chemical response in your body, and you need something even more bizarre. And then it just continues, progresses. So that which was unthinkable before now seems exciting and attractive because your mind is so, well, it's caught up in this alternate reality. So now people start seeking out sex relationships with people of the same sex, same gender, because that seems to be the new frontier that's exciting. You say, well, I don't understand how that happens. Good, stay where you are in your pure mind. I'm serious. I don't I'm gonna say that lightly. But this cycle has repeated itself over and over and over throughout history. Rome was an example. You know, we talk about Sodom and Gomorrah. That's another example. You say, well, homosexuality is a new thing. No, it's not. This pattern has repeated itself over and over and over, and God is giving a society over to that as punishment because they will fall internally because of it. You say, that's going to happen in the United States? I hope not, but it might. It happened to Rome. It's happened to other great civilizations before. And so when Paul outlines this, he's saying, well, I want you to see this here. Paul says, this is the will of God, your sanctification, that you abstain from sexual immorality. And not like in lustful passion, like the Gentiles who do not know God. There's a relationship between knowing God and honoring Him and how you conduct yourself sexually. When you suppress the truth of God, this other path you're going to follow. It's just inevitable. Now, will every person follow that path? He's showing the extreme, and that's what we're experiencing in the United States, right? The extreme, and whether you go down that path or not, you, a person in the world, society at large endorses it, right? And actually, they will prosecute those people that do not endorse it, right? And so we're looking in extremes here, okay? So look what he says. He gives them over now to degrading passions. And this idea of exchanging, because what did they exchange? The truth of God for a... Now they're going to be exchanging things. That which used to be normal and right for that which is abnormal. Now this is what's just this crazy, because people like to appeal to evolution as the model for how we arrived on this earth so they can leave God out, right? But when you look at evolution... What is the natural order of reproduction? Male and female. And if you make the claim you do not see homosexuality in the natural world, in terms of the animal world, you know, that's going to be a true statement. They're always going to come up with some bizarre asexual or something, you know. But when it is said of all mammals that it's generally true, is it all male and female? And everyone, if they're just honest and they look at this up, yeah, that's what's normal. So you don't like to use the word normal because that's a judgment call. That's which is natural. I don't know how you say it because everything you say is a judgment, a truth statement, isn't it? You know, and but here's what he's saying. They exchange the natural function. Biologically, a man is made for a woman is made for a man. They fit together. And who designed that? God did, and you have to look all throughout creation, you see the same way. That's why a bull has a harem, right? A bull, elk, has a harem of cows. Sorry, that was a hunting reference. This guy's going, yeah, we're trying to get that bull, adrenaline, right? But now, it's not exclusive to men, but it's women as well, and then he turns to the men. The same way, the men abandoned the natural function and burned in their desire towards one another. Men committing indecent acts and receiving in their own person the due penalty thereof. Okay. I have to qualify these statements. I was going to do, I'm still going to do a workshop, seminar, you know, for a congregation up in North Washington with the youth about sexual issues with youth, because it's really a big issue we have to talk about. And when you read a lot about it, you have to read about it if you're going to talk about it in a frank way, and you have to have the knowledge. And so I would, kind of joke with some of the elders and the preacher up there, says, yeah, the last thing I want to do is become a sex expert, to talk about these issues. But you have to if you're going to talk about it. Once the United States Attorney General commissioned a panel to investigate the effects of pornography, I have their findings. It's a thick book. And James Dobson sat on the board and then viewed all the pornography, all the various types, read all the material. And he says, in spite of his findings, he says, the worst thing is I can never get these things out of my mind. You can't unsee them, the deviant acts and the things that were not natural. And now I say all that. Often this lifestyle is presented as just a matter, an issue of love. What's wrong with people loving people? Right? Yeah. That's often how it's presented. That people, they're just in love. And why are you going to deny them love? And my first response would be, anyone can love anyone. We're not talking about loving people. We're talking about the sexual act that God says is unnatural. So then you pull back that screen of love and look behind it at the sexual act. What they do so often is so deviant and so, I can't even find the words right now. Horrid? Abhorred. I wouldn't even begin to describe some of the acts, but it's not just what you might think as normal intercourse. It's things that are way beyond that. And it's just for sexual pleasure, and the more bizarre that it can get, the more excited they are about it. So when it says they burn, that's exactly what it's talking about. They're burning in their passions for one another. It's not about love when it really comes down to it. But that's the side society never sees. They just hear it's an issue of loving one another. Now, that's what Paul's describing here. Now, when that happens, God finally says, I'm just going to give you over to depraved mind. That's the last one. So notice the three things. I'm going to give you over depraved lust. What was the first one? Let me look at my... I'm sorry?
Passions.
Yeah, lust, passions, now mind. Now your very thinking becomes depraved. See the full will? The mind is being driven by the will, because I chose to suppress the truth of God. I come up with this alternate reality. God gives me over. I start following my own desires. That comes back now and totally affects the way I think and everything. Now, you take anyone that has truly been, what's the word I'm looking for, like in an AA program, rehabilitated, I didn't want to use that word, but recovered, yes, okay. Does their thinking change?
It has to,
because while they live for the drink, that's all that controls their thinking. That's all that controls their thinking. They'll lie, they'll deny, they'll cheat, anything just to get that next drink. And their mind is severely affected by just this addiction. Now, is it true with drugs? A theft in Portland, what is the motive behind most of it? To get more drugs. And people do the meanest, cruelest things with no regard for humanity just because they need the next fix. And so that's a penalty that God is allowing a society at large to suffer because they've suppressed the truth of Him. See how it devolves? Yes.
I had an officer tell me that 80% of all criminal behavior in Salem is in one way or another associated with meth.
Yeah. 80%, she said, an officer said, that of all crime in Salem is somehow associated with meth. or probably some other drugs. And that's similar statistics you see elsewhere. Yes?
Wood said that if we accept same-sex marriage, the next step will be, well, I love children.
Right.
So somebody will be already seeing that child.
That's already happening. Yeah. Yes.
And the next step will be, well, I love my dog.
Yes. Yes.
And that is where we're headed.
Now, with this all being said, And this almost becomes cliche, but we have to keep saying it. We're talking about the sin, not about the people. God so loved the world. And does that include everyone involved in these activities?
Yes.
That he gave his only son, that his wrath wouldn't come upon the individual. He allowed his wrath to come upon Jesus. You understand that? Jesus suffered the wrath that every one of us should have received. So we don't have to perish, but we can be saved. And that has to be our attitude to anyone that's engaged in this lifestyle, whether it's meth or any kind of same-sex, you know, lifestyle. We love them passionately, but we hate what Satan has got them into. And we have to make that really clear. Yes.
Well, and then it's interesting because God offers hope to these people, and they're hopeless.
Yes.
In their addiction.
That's right. That's right.
To be in, and that's thanks to Satan.
That's right.
Who had done that and presented these temptations to him.
Right.
Now, God, on the other hand, presents hope to these people. In fact, he's the only hope.
That's right.
That's going to fulfill that terrible void that's inside.
That emptiness.
Soul.
Yeah.
Because he can fill them up again. And what's so interesting is the scriptures say, and such were
some of you. That's right.
You were in that.
All right.
It's just beautiful hope that people
that's realize right.
is there for them in the scriptures.
That's right.
And they're this wonderful God.
That's right. Yet Paul's saying he's going down this path because we have to understand the gravity of sins before we appreciate the love of God, the goodness of the gospel, right? Last thing he says, these things are not what? You know, I used to felt like I was compelled not to offend people or be politically correct, to sometimes soft sell God's distaste for sin. And what I'm saying is that I would just soften the approach. And now I realize, you know, in the last few, I don't know how many years, that no, these things are not proper. And people, well, I'm offended by that. I'm sorry. They're not proper. They're not appropriate. They're not normal. And you can call it for what it is without being argumentative or mean or hateful. It's okay to say things are wrong. And that's what we have to do. And lovingly. Now, if you're involved in any of these things too, they're not proper. They're wrong. And you're continuing down a cycle, a slippery slope, a spiral into total depravity. Now, you might not hit the bottom. I don't know where it is. But anywhere along that continuum is not a good place to be because you're going to receive the wrath of God. Yes, quickly.
One other thing I just do want to say is that there are scans of people's brains, and it shows the depravity in the brain.
Yes.
Brain scan. So, I mean, really,
it affects their thinking, yes.
It changes and alters our brain. And I'm telling you, it's a serious thing. And you need to be aware of that. Don't go down the path.
Right. And we have that discussion that once you make certain choices over, pretty soon you get hardwired and you don't even have to consciously make the choice anymore. And you just automatically react. And so he gives them over and to depraved mind. And so that's why we have that last list. And I'm not going to read it again, but notice what he says in verse 28. They did not see fit to acknowledge God any longer. See, that's the suppression of truth, right? So he gives them order to depraved mind, to do the things which are not proper, filled with all unrighteousness. Then he gives this list of all these terrible things, slanderers, haters of God, boastful, disobedient to parents. But notice verse 32, they knew the ordinance of God. He's going back to the beginning, full circle. They knew. And that's not the issue, that they didn't know. And that those who practice these things, they knew what? They're worthy of? Everyone knows certain things. They're wrong. Yet they do the same, and they also give hearty approval to those who practice them. That pretty much characterizes Rome of his day. And it characterizes a lot of societies since then. Now, that's one extreme. And if you were a Jew that was raised in the Jewish culture, went to synagogue every day, and were taught that you are God's chosen holy people, when you heard this talking about the world at large, the non-Jews, what would you say as a good, upright Jew? Amen. That's right. They're all going to hell, right? Because they understood all this. So what is Paul going to have to do now? Let's talk about you guys. All right? You Jews. Now, that's where we're going to turn our pivot and turn our attention to now. And you say, well, is he speaking about the Jews exclusively? He's going to be talking about, for our benefit, anyone that is religious or self-righteous. Or some people call it the moralist. What's a moralist? The one that has a high awareness of morality, but because of that morality, that awareness, they become elitist in it and superior and snobbish, and they're always condemning everyone that doesn't stand up to that standard. So they're can be very judgmental. Now, when we're going to use the word judge in here, Paul's going to use it several times in chapter 2. He's not talking about just judging someone as like a trial. The word judge means condemn. So when you see the word judge, means condemn. He says, we know that the people that practice these things are worthy of death. We just read that. That's the condemnation, that if you're involved in these things, you're worthy of death. Talking about in the end picture. And so judgment means condemnation. Just not judging them as far as a trial as to right innocence or guilt. You're just not worthy, period. And there it leads to a self-righteousness. And it's self-righteousness because they cannot see their own unworthiness in that. And that's what plagues most religious people of the Jewish day. Most, not all of them. And it still plagues people who subscribe to any type of religion day, even Christianity. They think by being part of a religious club called Christianity, and I'm not talking about true Christianity, that gives them a pass on judgment from God. They just got a pass. They're somehow privileged. And you say, well, where do we get this? The Jews thought they were very privileged. I got some quotes from you in your handout so you can read them on your own. But their idea that since they were God's chosen people, his holy nation, as a community, they were all guaranteed eternal life in the next life to come. And it was not an issue of individual accountability. Because you are part of the club of Israel, you're guaranteed to live with God. You understand? Because you have the blood of Abraham in you. And you are therefore part of this holy nation. You get a pass. Everybody else is going to have to stand in judgment before God. So Paul's going to have to deal with that. That no. It's not that way. There's no pass for being religious. There's no pass. You don't get special treatment. Second of all, judgment's going to be universal. And it's individual. Every man will give an account of his deeds. It's universal, and every person's going to have to stand alone. Thirdly, he's going to say that your Jewishness actually makes you more accountable because you knew more than anyone else. So we don't have time to go through any of those but the first one, and we want to do that. So there's no escaping God's judgment is what he's going to say. There's no pass. Then he's going to turn to their guilt specifically. Because when he's done, he's going to come to this conclusion in chapter 3. When Paul's done with his discussion, who's there that is left standing? I'm talking about those outside of Christ. You with me? Who can say, I'm righteous? When he's done, who can say that? Nobody. Nobody. That's his conclusion. There's none righteous, not even one. So who needs Jesus? Everyone. But we got to get them to see this before they'll accept that they need Jesus. Yes. Oh, all right. So, oh, yes.
I was going to say, I do need Jesus.
Oh, you're raising your hand. Who needs Jesus? You were so involved in it. Go, I do. Yes.
Yeah, what's so scary to me and should be to all of us is how quickly this nation in 70 years from the 1940s and 50s has gone from things that we wouldn't even have to talk about.
Yeah.
To where it's paraded in our streets.
That's right. And you know what scares me more? How quickly the church has gone down the same path. That we think we have a pass. I'm not saying us here, but Christianity at large, we're excused from that same process because so too many Christians are involved in the same things and they don't understand they're going to have to give an account for those because that's not following Christ. You're on your own when you live that way. So anything you say is true about the world at large, but it's also true, and it happens right here. Individuals think, well, I got a pass because I'm part of the church. No. They didn't give you a pass. There's no religious exception. None. Either you're following Christ faithfully, it's all about faith, or you're not. Doesn't matter where your membership is. It's not some club. And so what you say is true, but I have to bring it home to us because we have to squirm, because if we don't squirm, we'll never accept Christ fully and we'll never follow him, you know, fully either. Yes.
In the first chapter, he's primarily talking to the Gentiles, those who don't know God, mm-hmm. and about the practices they have. The second chapter, he's talking to the Jews and those who are supposed to know God and think they get a pass.
Right.
Those both chapters are talking to Christians.
Right. Because he's writing to Roman Christians, not to non-believers. Yes. Someone else had their hand up. Yes. Yeah.
We give party approval. I hear people say, well, don't judge them because
right.
they can't help themselves or something like that.
Yeah, now people are enjoying it. It's great. It's a great alternative. It's actually endorsed. That which once was evil is not bad. Well, first verse, and we're done, and because we're out of time. I just want to introduce it since we spent this time. Oh, verse 1. I left verse 1 out. Where's verse 1? Oh, there it is. You are without excuse, every man of you, I think he's there talking to Jews, who passes what?
Judgment.
When you see the word judgment, what do you think?
Condemnation.
Condemnation. For in that you judge another, who do you end up condemning? Because you what? You practice the same things. Now that's going to be his premise for the rest of this chapter. Because to judge others, it means you have to have an awareness of a standard of morality, correct? You cannot condemn someone for that which you don't know is wrong. So when you condemn someone, you're saying, I know that is right and that is wrong, right? And second of all, when you condemn someone, you're acknowledging that everyone's accountable to doing that right or wrong. There's accountability. And then what's the one thing they're leaving out of this picture?
Themselves.
That includes me. I'm accountable. And it's too often I hear Christians complaining about other people's and really condemning them, criticizing them. And you know how that says, every time your finger's pointed at someone, there's what, three more fingers pointing back at yourself. Because you might not have committed adultery, but you might have lusted in your heart. And Jesus said what?
Same thing.
Now that's where we're going to go in chapter 2. If you don't want to squirm in your seat, don't come back next week, all right? If you ever judge someone, don't come back, because I'm going to be talking about you, okay? No, do come back, all right? Because we need to hear this. Thank you.